Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm very pleased to have my friend Tricia McKinnon on the show to discuss her great book, Jesus, the Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years and the Ancient Mystery Religions. This is a book that really, it was one of the books that every 5 years or so a book comes along that really shakes you at the basis of who you are, and this did it for me. I just love this book, and Tricia has a wonderful background in order to write this book. It's very unique and one that is makes her particularly an expert at the background that this book is set in. And it's one that we're not taught about in regular religion. I went to Methodist Sunday school and Bible school and never heard any of this. And it's very, very important because we're living in an age now where a lot of people are being killed in the name of religion, and religious wars are still on TV every night. And we need to, we need to really understand the basis of the Christian religion, and this book helps us do it. Thank you very much for joining us today, Tricia.
Oh, Dr. Kolb, it's such a pleasure always to be on, and I hope you don't mind me calling you Susan, because, of course, we are friends.
No, please do.
But I know you're such an accomplished doctor, too, and so it's always a pleasure to be on with your listeners and the Temple of Health that does so much good for so long for so many people in the world in terms of holistic health and healing. And as you know, it's not just physical. It's also our thoughts, our emotions, and what we've come to believe, which to a large degree is programmed, of course, by our societies and by our religions, by the cultures that we grow up in. And I think this is one of the reasons that I was really so motivated to write the book. As you may know, I actually was in the middle of writing a book about the great spiritual mysteries and the importance, actually, of the divine feminine and the divine mother and bringing the feminine and masculine into balance. And that's actually the new book that I've been working on this year that's not out yet. And I was very deeply engrossed in that, and I had included 3 chapters on Jesus because I think that he is such a beautiful example of a balanced human being, a truly enlightened, God-man who walked the planet, who said that these things I do, you too shall do in greater, telling us that, in fact, the potential that he realized lies within each and every one of us as God men and God women, if we'll but claim it. And so I had included 3 little chapters in this new book on him, and the book got too big, basically, and I thought, well, what am I going to do? And my solution was to actually pull out the 200 pages on him that I had written inside of what was now a much larger book. And, you know, I never intended actually to write 200 pages even on him, but because I come from a very traditional Christian family in the Deep South, my dad was Baptist, my mother was Methodist, we attended both churches, then we became Episcopalian, believe it or not, which is sort of like Catholic light, and I was confirmed there where I was 13, and then my older sister became a Presbyterian fundamentalist who's married to a fundamentalist preacher. And so, while they're very good moral people, in the name of religion, I've seen a lot of emotional judgment and harm and separation being done within the family structure. And a lot of things that should have been about uniting us, which is through the power of love and forgiveness, I actually experienced in my own family as being very divisive. And so, as you know, I'm a clairvoyant. I've been able to see angels and fairies and divas and spirit guides around people my whole life. I've done about 6,000 clairvoyant readings for people all over the world. And I had become trained through the years in a number of ancient wisdom traditions, including the Egyptian, which is really one of the, let us say, streams of greatest wisdom that still existed, from which many of the other wisdom traditions in a more watered form came from. The Eastern traditions, the masters of the Far East that had initiated me when I was about 19 years old, that's another profound mother stream of wisdom. The Native American twisted hair tradition, they claim to go back some 230,000 years in their history of the planet. The goddess traditions, the Celtic, Druidic traditions, these were all mystery traditions that I had studied, become very immersed in, become initiated in. So I understood how all these various streams of consciousness from different places around the world come together in a unifying place. And of course, because of this, I had collected a lot of ancient secret hidden books about mm-hmm. Jesus. Gospels, not only from the Nag Hammadi texts and the Dead Sea Scrolls that have come to light in the last 20 years, but also Gospels from the Far East and from England, and where Joseph of Arimathea set up the first Christian community in the world in 37 AD, and other places that really talked, they were the teachings of Jesus before they were corrected by what were called the Catholic correctorites. When the Orthodox Church basically decided on its canon, as you know, we only have four Gospels, canonical Gospels mm-hmm. in our New Testament, but there were over 60, and some say as many as 200 other books that were left out. Well, of course, since 1945 and 1947, with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi text, many of these were discovered and have slowly been translated in the last 15, 20 years, they've started coming to light and being published, thank goodness. But there are others that most people know nothing about at all, which has really shifted a lot of theologians' perception and historians' and biblical scholars' perceptions about what Jesus really taught. Because this new book, by the way, that I'm working on that's not out yet, which is sort of a follow-up to the book. You were talking about Jesus, the explosive story of the 30 lost years in the ancient mystery traditions. This new book is really about the discovery of the secret teachings of Jesus's about reincarnation. He speaks openly about that. He speaks openly about the divine feminine and the divine mother and the importance of honoring the divine feminine as well as the divine masculine. Mm-hmm. You know, he basically says that it all resolves back into one, but from this one comes the two imperishable names, the eternal ones, mm-hmm. the Divine Mother energy, which the Gnostics call Sophia, the goddess of all mm-hmm. wisdom, and the Divine Father energy. Jesus also talks about the fact that there's a Divine Son and a Divine Daughter, and of course he would be one of the Divine Sons that has come to Earth, and he says that they continually reincarnate in the world in order to try to bring enlightenment to humanity. He says that the Divine Mother comes in as his mother, as his mate, and as his daughter, and that mm-hmm. That he comes in as her father, as her mate, and as her son. And so this is actually the new book that I'm working on. I'm kind of giving you a little bit of a preview. But
that's great.
Yeah, it's really amazing, and I think one of the challenges, I think, in writing the book that I'm working on now, it's been hard to figure out how to name it, because I've been using the working title, Awakening the Heart of the New World Age, which I think mm-hmm. is a great title, because ultimately what Jesus talks about is that the male and female polarities must come together in the heart, and this is why he taught the power of unconditional love. And he also talks about the fact that the two can be pulled up the spine through the Indha and the Pingala, or, as you know, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems that control the voluntary movements. That would be the masculine, the sympathetic, and the parasympathetic is, of course, the autonomic nervous system that runs our body all the time, like breathing and digesting and so forth. And it's when you bring those two into union, balance, and awake, connecting the left and right hemispheres of the brain, that we activate the third eye. And that's mm-hmm. part of the spiritual technology Jesus taught.
Right, it is.
And I remember being in Bible school and asking my teacher, why is nothing that Jesus wrote in the Bible? So your book is an answer to that. And I think we'll find out, because of what you're talking about, why it wasn't included in the Bible. There were political reasons.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. This is one of the things that it has been so powerful to me, is I was just like you. I knew that there was a deeper level of inner wisdom mm-hmm. that he must have taught to the apostles that could understand it. And as we sort of know, as we've gone back and started to look at those apostles, many of them were very good people, obviously, and they were devoted to him. But some of mm-hmm. them, you know, were more, they didn't have education, they were more basic,
right.
and they had been steeped in the patriarchal teachings of Judaism mm-hmm. at the time. And so
right.
Apostles like Peter really, really struggled. And, you know, mm-hmm. unfortunately, even though the Catholic Church murdered Peter, they literally, on the place where the Catholic Church is seated now, the Vatican is seated, they claim mm-hmm. that it's the Church of Peter, which is so strange
right.
to me, since they murdered him. But
yeah.
then you had other apostles that were, let us say, much more profound, like John, the Beloved,
mm-hmm.
and Mary
right.
Magdalene, and some of those mm-hmm. who really seem to have grasped the deeper subtleties behind what Jesus was talking about. But
mm-hmm.
as you know, when he was teaching, he was having to encode a lot of his wisdom into parables and allegories, because
mm-hmm.
That way people could take them at whatever level that they were on, and
right.
also it prevented him from being arrested so quickly, because if he
right.
if he told
he just
people
told
directly,
stories, yeah, right.
yeah. The Jews at the time were, you know, pretty fiercely connected to their money and their power base
mm-hmm.
and so forth,
right.
and they weren't really interested in having somebody truly enlightened, you know, free the masses from their power.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So, yeah, I've been very excited about this new book, and I've thought about calling it just Reclaiming the Lost Wisdom Teachings of Jesus and the Divine Mother. And you can vote on any of these titles, by the way, and I'm perfectly willing to have our radio guest vote on them, because it's still in motion. I've thought about calling it Isis, Sophia, and Mary, you know, because
mm-hmm.
really during the course of the book, it's the rediscovery of this divine female aspect
mm-hmm.
that was expressed by many different names within the ancient culture. We in
right.
Christianity know her as Mary. And
mm-hmm.
in Judaism, she was known actually as Sophia, and Greek mm-hmm. philosophy as Sophia. And in Egypt, of course, she was known as Isis, the
mm-hmm.
She of 10,000 names and 10,000 faces, who represented the all the many aspects that the Divine Feminine can play out in the world.
Well, so, pretty much in the world of duality, any time where you get to one side or the other, you get out of balance. And Buddha taught this, you know, the middle path, that whenever you have opposing energies, the spiritual lesson is to balance them and to take the middle path. So, you know, I think it's very consistent in all the mystery schools that this is, you know, this is what we are evolving into, is the, you know, the taking the different you know, extremes of the polarity, and then and joining them, and not, you know, not falling off the edge of the, you know, the lesson into insanity. And of course, our world is pretty much still an insanity. And well, it
yeah,
is. I mean,
it's
yeah.
really well said.
not,
you know,
it's not balanced. And you know, the only way we're going to get to the 1,000 years of peace that's predicted is where, you know, an awful lot of people are going to either change their minds or disappear from the landscape. So, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Last night I went to see Superman, the new Superman. And of course, that's a really
mm-hmm.
wonderful movie, and it's well cast in so many ways. A deeper character study of that. And I went with my sister and brother-in-law, and when we were over, you know, he said, well, you know, this is kind of a guy's movie. There were a lot of things blowing up and, you know, a lot of fighting,
mm-hmm.
a lot of war.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I said, well, you know, there was also a lot of emotion, a lot of character content and so forth. And, you know, that would be more of a, he said, well, you know, yeah, a chick flick is, you know, the emotions and, you know, the love and stuff. And I thought to myself, now, isn't this strange? You know, men have all the same emotions that we do. They, you know, they have, you know, great courage and heart and visions and dreams. And, you know, there are many men that has every bit as much depth and breadth of an emotional content as women. And they're also very active, dynamic, wonderful women in the world who, you know, are movers and shakers and make a difference. You know, you can look around and see them everywhere. But isn't it strange that this is the way they were? He was describing the guy's film was violent, blowing things up,
right.
You know, physical action. You know, was it violent? Was it war? You know, was it conflictual?
Right.
And a girl's movie was, you know, did they fall in love? And was there any emotions? Did they have some, you know, did we get some depth in their character? And I thought, now that is just so strange because in truth, both sexes have both of these things. But isn't it interesting how we characterize it, even just in, you know, the superficiality of going to the movies is, oh, it's a guy's movie or it's a girl's movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the really successful movies, And the one I'm thinking of right now is like Iron Man 3. The really successful series and movies actually combine the two pretty well, actually, and then add humor, you see.
You know,
a movie that's totally one or totally the other. I mean, if you look around in the theater, the chick flicks are mostly going to be women and the boyfriends they drag in or husbands they drag in. And then but the really successful movies are doing both, and that's what I was talking about earlier, merging both, because you can't be complete until you do everything well.
It's absolutely right, and I mean,
that's mastery. Isn't that mastery? That's what mastery
exactly.
is.
Exactly. In fact, you know, as you said, Buddha called it the middle way. Jesus called it the way. Thoth, the great god of wisdom in ancient Egypt, called it the ancient way. But this is exactly the way that people were taught within the mystery schools was to balance these two sides of our own nature.
And I was reading a book on spiritual female masters, and one master is called Mother. You may have heard of her. And she said you have to be hard as a diamond and soft as a rose. And, of course, in my world, I have to do both. You know, I have to be very compassionate with the patients who are ill, and yet sometimes, you know, given with certain things that happen or the employees that are out of line, I have to be hard as a diamond. You know, you have to have range is the point. You have to do everything. You can't just be a softie or just be someone who's, you know, a hard ass. You can't. You have to decide what you're going to do based on the circumstance. So that's for me the mastery that I'm achieving in this life is to have all the ranges where needed, you know.
Yeah, it's a very important thing, I think, for people to recognize and to remember within themselves, because I mean, if you actually, you know, you're quintessential with this, with your medical practice, because you see it at the physical body. You know, we all have estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, and DHEAH. You know, we all have the masculine and the feminine. We have them in different balances. But that's just literally the biochemical level. And what is it that makes guys want to blow things up? Is it the testosterone, you know, the urge for action? Yeah, so,
it is.
You know, like
it
get that testosterone in balance with your estrogen, and the same thing. You know, if you got, you know, if you don't have enough testosterone, you know, you just want to kind of sit around and eat potato chips and on the couch and watch TV.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all about that balance.
I have an interesting story about testosterone, which really made me realize its effect. I had this very prim and proper married lady who was very, you know, conservative and everything. And another doctor put her on testosterone, and she came to me. She says, you know, when I start wondering what's in every guy's pants, I know I'm on too much testosterone. And I just about broke out laughing because, you know, it's true. You can give somebody who's extremely feminine testosterone, and they will start to exhibit behaviors and sexual, you know, changes that are masculine. Almost become a sexual predator in, you know, for her, you know, it was very unusual thinking. So, yeah, testosterone does affect our thinking processes. And,
well, you know, it's a lot of
eating
fire.
Red meat does too. You know, I mean, that's why they say less red meat. You know, you're too aggressive.
So. That's very interesting. Well, you know, in mm-hmm. writing this book, I know we've done a couple of shows where we've talked some about this book that I wrote mm-hmm. that came out a couple of years ago. And let me just say the name for our audience members. It's Jesus, sure. The Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years and the Ancient Mystery Religions. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at my website, which is www.trishamcannonspeaks.com. And actually, you know, I have to tell you, I'm home for the summer. I've just come back from speaking in San Francisco at the New Living Expo, which is just great. It's, you know, 7,000 people that show up once a year for this amazing, you know, mecca of consciousness and just wonderful people. And then I was in New York the last 2.5 weeks of May, and that was great. I was up there doing speaking programs at the Meta Center mm-hmm. and TRS and Namaste Bookstore, and I was also at the Book Expo, which was just wonderful. And so, you know, I've just come home for the summer, and I'm working on getting a new site up, which, God willing, and the creek don't rise, will be up by the end of June, where I'm going to be offering a whole series of webinars on a lot of these great spiritual mysteries. In the last few years, you know, as I've continued to speak and teach all over the world, I've had a lot of people ask me if they could study the great spiritual mysteries, because mm-hmm. in truth, in the past, these mysteries were a unified body of knowledge that was taught in successive layers or levels of initiation, and they encompassed many of the things that, let us say, the New Thought or New Age movement in a more piecemeal manner is bringing around, like, for example, the study of aromatherapy or the study of herbs or the study of acupuncture or crystals or sound therapies or light therapies, some of these 21st century medical advances that are actually based on very ancient principles that were known in Atlantis. They were certainly known in Egypt and practiced at a very in a very specific, coherent way. Well, in our day and age, you know, we've had to bring these different practices back from a different point of view. Instead of starting at the center and saying, you know, there is a unified intelligence throughout the universe, let us call it God or Atum or the divine, and there is a, this intelligence has created patterns that can be studied, which the ancients called hermetics, the secret language of the mm-hmm. soul. And hermetics is like how the hologram of creation reflects back to itself. So, for example, iridology, the study of the eye, is something that indicates places that are in health or in wounding in the physical body. If you take this to another level, if you take a carrot and you cut a carrot and look at the carrot, it looks like an iris of an eye, doesn't it? Well, what are carrots good for? They're good for the eyes. Hermetics right. teaches things like grapes, which look like red blood corpuscles. They're good for the blood. So it's about reciprocity, basically, and this is all part of this more unified awareness taught within the mysteries that we've lost today. And so mm-hmm. the book that I wrote on Jesus is not only about where did he go, but it was where did he go, what did he study, what were the mysteries, how were they taught, what would he have mm-hmm. been exposed to, and then how is it reflected in his teachings? How can we tell that? And as I say in the beginning of that book, in the New Testament, the word mysteria or mysteries is used some 21 or 22 times in connection with his teachings. The apostle said the Lord taught all things in a mystery. And so this is because, of course, he was an initiate of these ancient mystery schools. He studied with the, he was in Egypt, of course, until he was about 7 with his parents. Then he wound up going with his mother and Joseph of Arimathea up to the Druids and the Celtic lands in Britain, because Joseph mm-hmm. of Arimathea, as you know, was mining silver and tin up there, particularly tin, which was used in the making of bronze, for weapons for the Roman Empire. So he was what they called a Roman decurion, which he had his own fleet of like 5 or 6 ships, and he was really one of the wealthiest men around, and he was gone a great deal managing this whole tin trade. So so then he came back and he was studied with the Essenes, the esoteric aspects of the Jews, from 8 to 13, and then he went back to the Celtic lands when he was about 14 or 15, and then he was just so advanced, they said, send him on. So they sent him on to India, where he studied for many years, and he began to teach his own wisdom, which, of course, immediately he wound up with 3,000, 5,000 followers who were just hanging on his every word, because at that time in India there was a very strong caste system, and a lot of the lower classes, like the peasants and the farmers or the untouchables, they were never allowed to hear spiritual teachings. You know, the merchants and the nobles, they could hear it a few times a year, you know, and the Brahmins, of course, had control of it. So there had become a rigidity in the class system at that time that wasn't really serving higher consciousness. And Jesus, being the great Democrat that he was, taught everybody equally, because he saw all souls as being equally as loved by the divine. And so, you know, then the Brahmins and the powers that be thought, well, we're going to take this guy out. So they sent assassins to kill him. And he fled to a Buddhist community in the mountains of Rajagira, where he lived for 6 years. And he was actually acknowledged as the second Buddha that the first Buddha had predicted would come some 500 years after himself. He said a fully realized being would come. So that was very powerful. And then eventually when he left India, he traveled through the Silk Pass and the Silk Road to a place called Bukhara, which was one of the 2 or 3 very big cities along that path. And he was initiated in the Mithran Mysteries, which were great star mysteries in the cave of Bukhara. Those mysteries I find to be very deep and very profound, because they taught about the great cycles of time, the procession of the ages, and how human consciousness falls asleep or wakes up and is largely defined by these large astrological ages. And they also taught that there was a being that the Mithrans called the Saroshant, let us say the Son of God, who could insert himself into the worlds of matter whenever he chose, and that he usually came between the change of the ages. So, for example, Jesus came between the age of Aries that was ending and the age of Pisces that was beginning. And, of course, now we're at a very similar point where the age of Pisces is ending, the age of Aquarius is beginning. So we're really due for one of these beings. The Mithrans knew that Mithra had come between the age of Taurus and the age of Gemini. So many times they come, they're what the ancients call them, the great aeon, not eon, but aeon. The A-I-O-N, which is the incarnation, really, of the solar lord that comes to Earth to deliver the message for the new age that's being born on the planet, and to say, hey, this is the path to follow. I hope you get it. And then, you know, half the time we kill them, of course. You know how that goes. and then they leave their mark, hopefully, and the message gets out. So, you know, a lot of my work is very much about trying to bring a more integrated spirituality to the world, a more unified vision, where we really learn about the true wisdom teachings of Jesus that were have nothing to do with the prejudice and the dogma and the judgment and the secular mindset that we find in religions today that's so exclusive, because Jesus was very inclusive. You know, he was a student of all these ancient wisdom teachings. And then, of course, in my book on Jesus, the whole last section of the book is about his 7 years of study in the temples of Egypt. When he came back to Jerusalem, he spent a few years, about 3 years, and then he went up to the Celtic lands when he was about 30, probably just for a visit to make contact again with important teachers and friends. And then he went into the temples of Egypt. So he didn't start his ministry at 30 and end at 33, as most Christians have been told. He probably didn't start his ministry until he was about 37 or 38 or even 39. And the reason we think he started at 30 is because Luke, in the Gospel of Luke in the Bible, it says, Luke, who, by the way, did not know Jesus, Luke was like Paul. He came along later after the crucifixion. And Luke said that Jesus appeared to be, you know, an attractive, comely man around 30. However, if you ever
read the Gospel...
He
probably looked younger, right.
I'm sure he looked younger, considering his years of meditation.
That's right.
But, you know, if you ever read the Gospel of John, there's a whole passage in John where Jesus is talking to these Jews, and he says, before Abraham was, I am. And the Jews are like, what, man, are you crazy? You're not yet 50. Well, you know, you might say that to a 40-year-old or a 45-year-old or a 42-year-old.
But not a 30, yeah.
You wouldn't say it to a 30-year-old.
Right.
And so this is one of the big problems is that, you know, in fact, a lot of the early church fathers, even within the orthodoxy of the church, had a very big problem with the fact that they made Jesus out to be so young. Tertullian actually says, you know, he was in his, like, that last, you know, the prime and the third, like the last third of his life, to which, you know, in the ancient traditions, they knew there was the youth, the man, and the sage. There was the maiden, the mother, and the crone.
Right.
And it was in that last third of our life that we finally take all these experiences that have sometimes been so difficult and painful, and we're able to extract a level of real integration and wisdom from them.
Mm-hmm. So, and probably in that age, 60 was about what people lived, so... 40 to 50 would be that wisdom time.
Zero to 20, 20 to 40, and 40 to 60, that would have been the sage phase.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that book is it's a great book. I get emails from people all the time who say, my God, you know, I've always suspected that there was a deeper story. And, of course, you know, this book I've written is not a channeled book. It's a historical book. I wound up getting access to some of the 570,000 documents hidden in the Vatican that no one has been allowed to see for over, you know, for hundreds of years. And that in itself was just kind of a remarkable story about how all of that unfolded. But I truly think that Jesus and the great spiritual brotherhood or sisterhood of light was totally behind the creation of that book, and also this next book, which is really about his lost teachings. The first book is about, maybe 350, 400 pages, but by the time you add the 100 pages of bibliography and appendixes and back matter, you know, added about 100 pages to the book. So we had to pull 200 pages out of that book about the lost and secret teachings. So this is one of the reasons why this book that I'm writing now is so very important, because it's really bringing the balance of his teachings, hopefully, back into the world.
Well, it's a book I've been waiting for. I'm so glad you're writing it.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you very much. I'm excited about it, and I was actually handcuffed to the computer January, February, March, and April before I started traveling, which is kind of what it takes to write a book like this.
It's very
research-intensive. But as soon as I get this new website up, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, July is going to all be about finishing the book. So hopefully by the end of the summer, you'll get a chance to read it if you want to.
Yeah.
And I'm probably going
to
post a little of it online. So,
That'd be great. Well, I wanted to have you talk a little bit about Mary. I think people don't realize Mary's story and how that was, you know, the Essene tradition and everything was so important in her life, and then, of course, became important in Jesus' life. Because, you know, we never hear about that, and yet, you know, they were immersed in a, you know, a spiritual religious Jewish tradition called the Essenes.
The Essenes actually grew. The Essenes grew out of the Therapeutae, and the Therapeutae, the name Therapeutae actually comes from Therapeutus. Therapeutus mm-hmm. was one of the ancient names for Thoth, the god of wisdom in Egypt. So there were mm-hmm. Essene communities or Therapeutes communities or both in Egypt. And Egypt at that time, of course, was the incredible melting pot of Egyptian, Greek, Jewish, Buddhist thought. I mean, really all the wisest philosophers, you know, mm-hmm. were there. Pythagoras studied there. Plato studied there. And so forth. And that was all, you know, around 500, 450, 400 BC. And then the Therapeutae slowly made their way as the Essenes into the Jewish culture. But as the Essenes talk about, they sort of felt like that with the death of one of the teachers, which I'm sure was one of the members of the Great White Brotherhood, around 200 BC, they called him the first teacher of righteousness. They felt like they kind of lost their way. And then, of course, what was actually happening, the politics at that time, was the Syrians began to bombard and invade Jerusalem and Egypt. And they did some real damage. They murdered a lot of the priest, and so forth. And so the Maccabee rebellion took place around, you know, 150, 160 BC. And the Maccabees were just good hill people, kind of like friendly hillbillies, you know, who said, mm-hmm. you know, we don't want to put up with the tyranny of Syria. So they wound up overthrowing the Syrians, and then they took over, and they became the royal household, the Hashemonian dynasties. But they didn't have the wisdom. They didn't have the knowledge. So they. This is how a lot of that Jewish, deeper Jewish wisdom got lost. And so the only people that were keeping it were the Essenes. And the Essenes, about 150 B.C., went out and set up Qumran and eight other communities. There were a total of nine of them, and some of them were very small. But Qumran, of course, and Mount Carmel were the two major ones. And Mount Carmel was up in Galilee, where John the Baptist and Jesus went to school. And it was kind of out of the reach of the group in Jerusalem. Southern Judea, the Pharisees and Sadducees had taken, you know, totally taken control. And the Essenes had set up Qumran in some of the small communities, but the real teaching schools were even further north in Galilee, which originally was settled actually not so much by the Jews but by a lot of the Gentiles. And some of them were Celts, which is why Jesus was more fair-haired. He wasn't dark-skinned mm-hmm. and dark-eyed and, you know, the whole right. Semitic Jewish thing. He had more of the Celtic bloodline. And, in fact, mm-hmm. his Mary's mother, Jesus' mother, so Jesus' grandfather, mother Anna, was actually from England, from Britain. She was, as they said, a Celtic princess from that bloodline. And mm-hmm. I actually did a lot of research on this in my books. And she had apparently been in a bad marriage and had fled that marriage from England and came into Brittany, and there are actually name places all through the British Isles that are dedicated to Anna, and then in Brittany, mm-hmm. and then she came into the Essene community because, of course, she was a Druid, and the Druids, the Essenes, all these were chapters of the Great White Brotherhood or the mystical mm-hmm. spiritual orders, and she remarried an Essene and, had Mary, Jesus' mother. So Mary and Mary Magdalene were part of an inner circle of highly trained female initiates. And Mary Magdalene, or Mary the Magdala, which means the watchtower or the great, Mary the Great, she had gone to study in Egypt with the priestesses of Isis. She had studied just as Jesus had gone in his path to study, she was like the female aspect of that. So she had been trained in the Egyptian teaching, she was younger, quite a bit younger than he was. So when he came back, for example, from India, I have accounts of him visiting with Lazarus and Mary and Martha, and Martha would be downstairs preparing the food. She was a little older, and Lazarus would be up laying on the roof, which were, they were more like slanted, flat roofs, not high pitched roofs, because they didn't have snow in Jerusalem, looking at the stars and the desert night, and Mary would creep up there, who knows if she was 17 or whatever she was at the time, and listen to his every word, you know, and listen to all of his adventures. So when he went off to study in Egypt, she went off to study in Egypt, but they studied separately. She was in with the priestesses of Isis and the female mysteries, and he, of course, was taken into the inner mysteries of the panthers, which was the highest level of order, the pantheras. Pan means all. Thera means divine mother or divine female, like Theo, theology. Theo is God. Thera is God or goddess. He was Jesus ben Panthera, or Jesus son of the all God or the all goddess. So they studied in their respective streams, and I'm sure that they did have interaction with one another, although I'm sure their teachers probably kept them apart a great deal of the time because the focus was not on romance, it was on preparing for their mission. And, of course, this is one of the reasons why when Mary returned, she was not, she was always strange to the Jewish male apostles. It was kind of like, yes, you know, her with her strange ways or her, you know, she doesn't quite fit in and, you know, she's, you know, come from Egypt and she's been initiated in these other paths and we're not sure exactly what we think of her. So, you know, they sort of treated her like an outsider. And yet, as Jesus said, she was the one who knew the all. That's what he said, the one who knew the all, the apostle of apostles. And in all of the mystery schools, they had an outer order of study and an inner order of study. So the outer teachings were like the first level of initiation. They taught morality. They taught, you know, integrity, living a good life, living a life that has service and devotion and all that kind of stuff. The inner teachings were at a much, much deeper level of initiatic mastery. And Mary was given the job of being the overseer of the inner mysteries or the inner teachings, where Peter, the rock, was given the job of being the one on the outer teaching. And, of course, unfortunately, Peter never really got over his misogyny and judgment and prejudice against women.
So, not and you at all. Actually,
no.
Otherwise, we'd have female priests, wouldn't we?
Exactly.
And cardinals and popes.
Yeah. And when you read, like, the Gospel of Thomas or Philip, you know, at the end, I mean, there are things where Peter literally says, you know, why is Mary asking all these questions? Basically, tell her to shut up and leave. Women are not even worthy of life. I mean, this is Peter, the
it's
quote,
amazing.
The bedrock of the church. It's like, you've got to be kidding me. And Jesus said, you know, don't worry about it. I will make her anthropos. An anthropos is basically someone who has joined their male and female energies together in balance. It's exactly what you were talking about earlier, which is the path that brings us to mastery. And so it's one who's balanced the left and right sides of their brain. But, you know, there was just such extreme male prejudice that it was a very, it was, I mean, this is one of the things I think Jesus came in to do, was to rebalance the masculine and feminine. Each one of the ages, of the 12 signs of the zodiac, the 12 ages, most ages are around 2,160 years, some are longer, some are shorter, but they're basically right in there. And every one of those ages bathes the planet with a particular energy for the period of time that it's in effect. And, of course, the age of Aries, which was around 21-22-50 BC to around the time of the birth of Jesus, was ruled by the god of war, which is Mars. So what did we have? We had war, and more war. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks. You had the rise of Alexander the Great, the rise of the Roman Empire, all of that. And it was a very masculine, dominant age. When Jesus came in, part of his mission was to flip the age to the feminine polarity, because Pisces is a water sign, is all about feeling, emotion, you know, the kingdom of heaven is within, love is the answer, turn the other cheek, all that stuff. But as we can notice when we look at the two fishes, you know, there's a duality to the age of Pisces. We could do all those wonderfully spiritually inspired things, you know, and realize the unity inherent in all life, or we could become victims. And unfortunately, what happened is the patriarchy that was running the Jewish traditions, most of them at that time, and the Roman traditions, just decided to suppress the feminine, including, I think, a lot of the honoring of the feminine within themselves, embrace only the masculine. And so what we have was the victimizer, Mars the warrior, taking on the mantle of spirituality in the name of the Prince of Peace, then literally victimizing or murdering, you know, what, 5 to 9 million women during the course of the Dark Ages, 8 crusades, holy crusades, jihads. And that doesn't even address all the men, the beautiful men, the Knights Templars, the Cathars, all the many spiritual communities who tried again and again to bring a more balanced approach into play. It just, it, you know, it just didn't happen. So now we're at this very exciting place between the age of Pisces and the age of Aquarius, where at last we can come back into balance between the masculine and feminine. And Aquarius is very sort of androgynous itself. It's ruled by air, which is communication, like, you know, fiber optics, telephones, cell phones, computers, space travel, all those things. And it's also ruled by ether.
Internet.
That's the internet.
One of the biggest
changes
we've had.
And it's ruled by ether as well. So where Mars was ruled by fire, water was ruled by, Pisces was ruled by water. This age is ruled by air and by ether. And ether brings us to space. And so this is one of the reasons, again, why these stargates have opened and why you have UFOs, so many UFOs in the sky, and, you know, multidimensional realities being discussed, and, you know, television, and, you know, I mean, we've come light years in just 150 years. Think about from the telegraph, you know, in 1850 and 60. Here we are. We're not even 200 years into this, and we're, you know, I mean, we thought fax machines were great in the 70s and 80s, and now it's like, you know, cell phones. It's like Star Trek, beam me up, Scotty. You flip open your cell phone, and you say, you know, hey, I'm talking to somebody across the world.
Yeah.
It's amazing,
it's really
isn't
true.
It?
Yeah, it is. So communication is actually going to be a good thing for bringing people together, because the more people communicate, the less division and separation occur.
I think it's true. I think ultimately we figure out, especially if we all spoke one language, I don't think we'd have nearly the problems that we have had. But, you know, when I can, you know, project my own fear or shadow or whatever onto a stranger, you know, it's the Muslims, oh, it's the Chinese, oh, it's the Russians, okay? Then, you know, I can make them into whatever I want to in my own fearful shadow. But when I realize that the Russians are wonderful, cool, amazing, passionate, beautiful people, and the Chinese are inventive, quiet, humble people, and I realize that there are many beautiful Muslim people, that's not my strong suit in religion, but the Muslim people that I know are actually very lovely, heart-based, kind, honorable individuals. So then we stop making them the enemy, because we realize that they're just like us. They want to love and be loved. They want to have families and homes. They want to, you know, have dignity and a sense of purpose and work in their communities in a helpful way. And then all those barriers of projection and negative shadow begin to dissolve, because we realize that we're really at our core the same.
And one thing I want to mention, I got an email from Mexico, and it was all in Spanish. And it in broken English, it said, "I'm sorry, I don't know English well, so I'm going to write this in Spanish." And so I just plugged it in, you know, copy and paste, put it into Google Translate, and the whole thing translated into English.
So, oh my gosh, that's brilliant!
There goes your language barrier. And so if anybody wants to read your book in another language, just tell them to go do Google Translate. The whole book will be translated for them.
Well, that is very cool, and I'm sure some of the subtleties and so forth would be lost, but still, that's a very powerful thing. You probably get a lot of the gist of it. This book has been, it was really a journey of initiation to write it, because I had masters at my house. Literally every night, every day, I would write about 8 to 10 hours a day, and then I would go downstairs and make myself some supper, turn on the TV, and draw illustrations, because the book has over 100 illustrations. And we drew about 170 for it, and the publisher used a little over 100. And it was really a great honor to be in service to these profound masters day in and day out, and to have the great opportunity to be in service bringing that level of truth back into the world. And that's how I feel, actually, about this new book that I've been working on. I've gotten a hold of a couple of Gospels that were found in monasteries in the East. And they are, some of them are the Gospels that we have in our Bible before the corrector rites went in and edited them. Their entire chapters that they took out, their paragraphs, their words and lines, their whole passages. For example, if you remember in the New Testament, there's a whole section where Nicodemus goes to see Jesus right before the crucifixion, and he says to him, "How can a man be born again?" How can you get back in your mother's womb? And they pulled all the answers to that out except a couple of lines. Well, there's a whole passage where Jesus talks about reincarnation and how we're eternal souls and how we come into the world again and again, and how until we perfect our own natures, we're basically on this treadmill of reincarnation, of learning life's lessons, until we come into enough God and self-awareness. Well, of course, the way it is now, it doesn't really make any sense, but when you read the original, it's like, oh my gosh. And there are several others, like where the apostles were sitting by a well, and they saw a dead man being taken off to his funeral, and they say to him, "Master, you know, how does it work?" And he talks about the fact that there's a resurrection of the body and a resurrection of the spirit. And the resurrection of the body is when we reincarnate. We come in and we get a different body. Right. And that the resurrection of the spirit is that when we leave our body, if we're enlightened, we go up into those heavenly kingdoms. We remember who we are. We wake up and we have a whole bigger perspective. But, of course, when we come back down here, we get amnesia, darn it.
Right.
And, you know, we can't remember who we are.
Unless we're the Dalai Lama.
Yeah,
that's true.
I do readings for people all over the world, and I do past life readings and current life readings, and for some reason, I think I came in with my veils pulled back and a lot of my memory intact from those higher realms. I think I must have been one of those souls that said, "I will remember, I will remember, I will remember." You know?
Right.
But I do remember, and consequently, you know, ever since I was a child, I would look at people and be flooded with information about them, about their past and present and future. And I've done over 6,000 readings for people all over the world, and many times I think we have these areas of our life that aren't working because we have things from the past, whether it's a trauma mm-hmm. or a fear or a vow
right.
or some other thing that has happened that has caused us to not be able to step into the fullness of our joy or happiness mm-hmm. or empowerment. And so I went on over the last 25 years to be trained as a hypnotherapist. I do voice dialogue, holographic repatterning work, soul retrieval, and many other modalities. They're all about helping people to awaken, remember who they are, if they have areas where they're blocked, to dissolve and release those blocks, and to more fully claim the happiness and of who they really are. So I'm actually in Atlanta now. I do readings over the phone. About half my clients are that way. The clearing work I have to actually do in person, though. But I'm here if any of our listeners are interested in having a reading or exploring this or feel like that there's something strong that they want to dissolve. You can certainly, sure. again, go to my website at Tricia McCannon, T-R-I-C-I-A, McCannon, M-C-C-A-N-N-O-N, Speaks. At .com, or you can call me here in Atlanta. My number here is 404-355-2211, and you're certainly welcome to call, and I'm happy to speak with you about it further.
Tricia, we're at the end of our hour, but I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking to Tricia McCannon. Her great book, Jesus, The Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years, the Ancient Mystery Religions. Thanks so much for joining us, and we will be back next week.
I look forward to it, and I'll speak to you soon, Susan.
Okay, hon. Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye.